The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio. Hello, we began this podcast with one idea. We are human beings, and human beings tell stories. Nearly 600 episodes later, we are no less fascinated with narratives in all their forms. How are they put together? How can they change the way we view ourselves as individuals and societies? Who's in charge of the stories that we use to define us? Can this be manipulated for good or evil? Who are we? Why are we here? And how do we interact with each other? For all of those questions, we don't turn to mathematical equations or musical insights or mechanical achievements, as impressive and important as all those may be. When we try to explain ourselves to ourselves, we turn to stories. We'll have an expert in stories and storytelling, Professor J. Edward Chamberlain, here today on the History of Literature. Okay, hello, here we go. Stories and storytelling with the author of the book Storytelling, How Words Shape Our World. It's a subject close to my heart. And also close to my heart is my old friend Mike Palindrome, who's going to make the pitch for another storyteller, Flannery O'Connor, a master. We'll give him 15 minutes or so to tell us why he's been reading O'Connor and why we should read her works or reread them, as the case may be. And then we'll wrap things up with a My Last Book. Let's see, how about our travel expert, Iceland Green? We'll hear what she chose for the last book she will ever read. But first, we have some literary news. You may be aware that Taylor Swift has a new album coming out soon, scheduled for April, and it's called The Tortured Poets Album. Songwriting, she says, is something that actually gets me through life. I've never needed songwriting more than I did when I was writing the songs for this album, Tortured Poets. Well, well, well. Taylor Swift is not exactly a topic we generally cover here at the History of Literature, but I suppose she could use a career boost, so I'm happy to give her some free publicity. She wants to come on the show, but I keep turning her down. I'm not sure it's a great fit, and frankly, we might be a little too big for Taylor Swift. I would worry about her being mobbed by History of Literature fans. You know I love you guys, but you can be a bit much for someone not used to celebrity on the History of Literature podcast scale. Okay, so Tortured Poets is certainly an intriguing title to me, a fan of poets, both tortured and not so tortured. And she also said this, speaking of literature, she also said this in 2022, quote, "If my lyrics sound like a letter written by Emily Dickinson's great-grandmother while sewing a lace curtain, that's me writing in the quill genre." End quote. Okay, that's not bad. I like that she's got Emily Dickinson on her mind, and I also like that she doesn't just say a letter written by Emily Dickinson while sewing on a lace curtain. She says Emily Dickinson's great-grandmother. Did you catch that? She's not saying, let's see, I need to reach for an old fuddy-duddy, a kind of henpecked old, no, henpecked's not the right word. A hen, a kind of old hen. Someone in black and white. I need to reach for someone stiff and old and ancient. I'll reach for Emily Dickinson. No, no, she says it'd be Emily Dickinson's great-grandmother. That's who I would be. Okay. Not bad. And fans have also noticed, speaking of literature, that Swift's 9th studio album, Evermore, was released on December 10th of 2020, which happens to be Dickinson's birthday. Getting some connections here. Evermore, of course, has a nice 19th century ring to it, thanks to Mr. Poe and his Raven, who gave us the negative version of the word. And I'm looking for connections with Dickinson, but Dickinson didn't use either evermore or nevermore in her poetry, but she did use the word never quite frequently, and she used the less common word, at least less common for her, ever, 6 times in her poems. by my count, including in her poem, Refuge, which I'm going to read now. And I'm going to include a blank in place of one word, which I will fill in later. Here we go. Refuge. The clouds their backs together laid, the north begun to push. The forests galloped till they fell. The lightning skipped like mice. The thunder crumbled like a stuff. How good to be safe in blank, where nature's temper cannot reach, nor vengeance ever comes. Okay. Some great imagery there. Forests galloping until they fall, and lightning skipping across the sky like mice. This is why we read Dickinson. Thunder crumbled like a stuff. I'm not even sure I understand that, but I love it anyway. And then the blank I gave you. How good to be. You have this, all this raging nature, right? And she pivots and says, how good to be safe in blank. What do you think that word is? Good to be safe in, how good to be safe in, what would you say? Inside? Indoors? In a cave? In a shelter? In this church? How about that? How good to be safe in here, or in here with you? No. No, 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 no. Not in Emily Dickinson's world. That line is, how good to be safe in tombs. Tombs. The world is frightful. The tempest is here. Even the north is pushing. What is that? The north begun to push. North wind? Maybe? Or is it just north? She doesn't say north wind. Or the wind begun to push. She says the north is pushing. I'm thinking of it as the very corners of the world are moving, pressing, demanding we pay attention. North, that could be cold, coming down, demanding we pay attention, threatening us. It's almost an apocalyptic kind of night. Nature's temper is fierce. Who can't it get to? Who's safe? Dead people. How good to be dead and free from this scary vengeance that nature is visiting upon the world. Holy smokes. Dickinson has done it again. Just with that one word, tombs. How good to be safe in tombs. Good Lord, what a poet. And guess what? There's a reason why I was talking about Taylor Swift, because it turns out that today's most famous tortured poet, Ms. Swift, is related to the great Emily Dickinson. Yes, yes, it's true. They share a great grandfather. It's Swift's 9th great grandfather and Emily's 6th great grandfather. They were one and the same person, making Taylor Swift and Emily Dickinson 6th cousins 3 times removed, which is pretty close. Close enough for me, which gives us the nice image that Emily might be up there looking down at her somewhat distant relation, probably admiring Taylor Swift's lyrics and dancing along with the Swifties, if she can stand those crowds. Or actually, check that. I bet she has no time at all for those Swiftian concerts. But I bet in those moments when Taylor, the tortured poet, is looking into herself with writing as much of a need as it is a desire, I bet that's where Taylor Swift has company. Celestial company. Dickinson has told us there is refuge in a tomb, but she's also telling us by example, if not explicitly, that there is also refuge in the act of writing. And in that, she and Taylor, 6th cousins, 3 times removed, are even closer kin than that. Mike Palindrome is next. Thank you. Okay, today we're going to be talking about Flannery O'Connor. Now, unlike some of these other recommendations you've had for me, where you've recommended it and I have not gotten around to actually reading the work or the author, Flannery O'Connor is someone I know quite well, and I've been immersed in her stories, and we've done an episode on her, and I've sort of had a, I don't want to say love-hate relationship, but definitely there were times where I thought that she was as good as I could find, and I didn't even need to read any other short story writers. And then there are times where I think, I'm not sure, so sure that I would even recommend Flannery O'Connor to other people. So what's your take on the works of Flannery O'Connor?
I think she's a must read. Yeah. I think she's wrote in the 50s, 60s, American Gothic, Southern novelist. Only wrote two novels, wrote amazing short stories. I think her sense of humor alone is worth reading. I think the confluence of a woman writing in the 50s, 60s in the South, highly educated, went to IO Writers Workshop, but retaining this unique sense of humor. Like in, I like her essays, Mysteries and Manners, and she writes, you say that the serious writer doesn't have to bother about the tired reader, but he or she does because they are all tired. Mm. I mean, she is very, very alert about the way her writing conveys meaning and the way the reader is about to drop her and move on.
Yeah, she does seem to be, and she's kind of a master of her craft in her stories. She has such confidence and seems so good at getting to the effect that she wants. And like her humor, like you're saying, I appreciate the real sharp edges to her humor and the willingness to go straight to the violence and the bizarre. And she seems kind of fearless in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's like she approached her writing the way she approached life, that she scrutinized everything and she questioned everything. I mean, her relationship with religion is another reason why I find her so unique. And I read Wise Blood in my 20s and was astounded by the story. If people haven't read it, it's about a preacher who starts a new religion, the Church Without Christ, and goes about proselytizing and just questioning his own faith. And it's at turns resembles a Bible story, and then other times it's absolutely sacrilegious, and then other times it reminds you of Faulkner, but in this kind of more playful way. I mean, just the idea of a church without Christ to begin with.
Yeah, right. And she, that was always seemed like something that I could appreciate about her was her religion and her Catholicism because of her commitment to it. And you would think someone who is kind of coming out of an MFA type world and who has these, I guess, modern sensibilities, I don't know that she was exactly progressive, but she certainly was observant enough that she could see kind of some of the problems with the positions that her fellow Southerners were holding on to, or the traditions that they were clinging to, even as the civil rights movement was sweeping across the South. But one of the things that I always loved about her, because it was so fascinating to me, is I felt like the tendency that the literary types might have would be to kind of try to come to grips with religion by watering it down a little bit and to say, well, the Bible isn't necessarily the word of God, but it's a good set of metaphors that can help explain things that, you know, or just to kind of take away some of the absolutism of it in order to reconcile some of the contradictions and stuff. And she has this quote about the Eucharist, where they were saying, a friend had said, well, it's a pretty good symbol. And and Flannery O'Connor said, well, if it's just a symbol, then to hell with it. You know, like it's not, you can't say that it's a metaphor and say that it makes sense because it's a metaphor. It has to be real or it doesn't work. That's sort of the position that I understand her to be taking with respect to religion. And that makes her more interesting to me because it makes her someone that I want to read because she's going to think differently about things than I will.
Yeah, no, exactly. She starts with the supposition that she believes in God, but then everything, at least I take for granted and assume and expect that it is going to be predictable, doesn't follow from that.
Mm.
She is off in so many different directions when it comes to religion that it engages the reader and also kind of wins me over that there's more to religion than just doctrinaire faith.
Okay, so you would start with A Good Man is Hard to Find or one of the other short stories and then progress to Wise Blood. Is that what you would recommend?
Yeah, and I confess, I have not read The Violent. Is it The Violent Bears You Away? Or
Oh, yeah.
What
yeah,
a title.
Yeah. And what else have we got for Flannery O'Connor? Do you have three things about her?
Yeah, I mean, I recommend her, you know, her essays, Habit of Being and Mystery and Manners. I think she's cult favorite among writers because she's so full of writing tips that don't mince words.
Mm-hmm.
She's often quoted as saying that the problem with MFA programs are that they don't discourage more people to stop writing.
Mm, yeah.
But then there's stuff like, you know, she says, now learning to see is the basis for learning the arts, all the arts except music. I know a good many fiction writers who paint, not because they're any good at painting, but because it helps their writing. It forces them to look at things.
Mm.
A story always involves in a dramatic way the mystery of personality, which she had in spades. I think a lot of writers give advice that without even meaning to water it down is they're so hesitant to discourage a writer that the writing tips I find to be almost false.
Mm. Right. Right. And she also seems like she was so devoted to writing and to fiction and to literature. And I heard a writer once who was had a lot of success as a young novelist. And he used to say, well, you know, writing novels was the thing to do. And if I had come along in the 1970s, I probably would have made a film and been a director. And, you know, maybe in the 80s, I might have been a pop star. You know, it was just sort of like his view of novel writing was just that it was kind of something that college kids did. And then he was good at it because he was talented enough. But when you read his books, you kind of feel that like he's not really committed to the project of fiction. And Flannery O'Connor seems like she was all in, right?
Yeah.
When you read the fiction, you feel like the fiction matters to her and that the story she's telling, it almost feels like life and death that she's got to tell this story in the right way.
Yeah. If she had a choice of careers, professions, I think she would choose any choice of any profession, she would choose being a writer. And I'm not that sure that's the case with all writers.
Mm-hmm. And she was all in other ways too, all in with Catholicism. And she struggled with her illness and she took care of her mother. And she just seems like she had this life. It's almost like a monk-like existence in some ways where it gives her this sort of air of mystery that she was so devoted to writing fiction through all of the turmoil or the, maybe turmoil is not the right word, maybe struggle in her life.
Yeah. And, you know, she was set to move to, I think the story is she was set to move to New York after starting to publish. She was a very popular writer among the literary set, but she moved back down to the South to take care of her dying mother.
Mm.
And her social world closed up and she never made it out of her hometown. So,
yeah. Now, have you read her recently?
I did. I just read Good Man is Hard to Find.
Yeah.
Reread it, you know, that's the story. I always recommend it to people.
Yeah, that one holds up, I think, right? The thing that I worry about is that some of her views are kind of distasteful. And I worry that if I read too much of her essays and so on, or her letters and so on, I end up feeling like, oh, well, she's of that era where she had all of these ideas that now just seem like wrongheaded.
Yeah, there's been some revisiting of her letters and her racism that's hard to talk out of.
And in the stories, it's almost like I feel like maybe her best self was writing these stories. Maybe that's the way to look at it. Because as in Faulkner as well, maybe that when she's exposing the hypocrisy is where we see her at her best, because that's a world she knows. She knows the hypocrisy of the woman who's holding on to traditions even as the world slides past her. And maybe that's what we can take from it, even if we wouldn't want to nominate Flannery O'Connor to be the president of the world these days.
Yeah. I mean, she's post Faulkner, post Hemingway, but the 50s is, it's 75 years ago. I mean, it's.
Yeah, right. So you make some allowances for writers and their personal views.
I guess nobody wants to hear this, but other writers have said and done worse.
And you read them.
I read them.
It doesn't really bother you if a writer was a Nazi, for example. You'll go ahead and read their work anyway. You draw that distinction between an artist and their personal views.
I mean, Dostoevsky, for example, was a staunch anti-Semite. And there probably is, like, every few years there's a little outcry, and then it's sinks into the mud. I mean, and people, there's no sustained attack on him.
Right.
I love him, so I love his books.
Okay, so we'll read some Flannery O'Connor, and then we'll read some Dostoevsky. And who else are you going to throw in there? Newt Hampson, maybe?
I'm not the biggest fan of his, but because I'm reading the Knausgård books, I feel like maybe I will try to read Hunger. I mean, and then him meeting Adolf Hitler, I didn't know this, but apparently Adolf Hitler was really offended that Hampson didn't show him enough deference. So that warmed me to Hampson's side, even though he was a Nazi, I think he was a Nazi supporter.
Right. Okay, well, the timer is about to go off, so we'll leave things there.
What a dark turn.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
Hello, everyone. This is Jack, here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor. And they're delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing. Chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, that was Mike pointing us toward one of his favorites. We will look forward to our rereading of Flannery O'Connor. And now we have a scholar of storytelling here to tell us some stories about stories. Okay, joining me now is Professor J. Edward Chamberlain, an expert on the mechanics and ethics of storytelling. He's here today to discuss his new book, Storylines, How Words Shape Our World. Ted Chamberlain, welcome to the History of Literature.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with some definitions. I think here at the History of Literature, we tend to think of novels and narrative poetry and films, but I think the scope of your project is a bit broader. What kinds of stories do you look at in your book?
Well, I look at the whole range of storytelling. I go back to the origins of the word story and narrative to tell something. So it's storytelling I turn to, and the storytelling takes a variety of forms in the book, from print and performance to verbal and visual, and including, because this is fairly important in many traditions, a whole range of gestures that tell stories in performance. And so I'm expanding rather than limiting the notion of stories and storytelling. The complication for the word story is the way we use it beyond human sort of stories. We talk of the track of an animal as telling a story. Now, did the animal leave that track deliberately? Well, we're not so sure about that. Scientists talk about a core sample telling a story. And what I talk about in the book is stories that are made with some intention and with a expectation that they will make us believe them.
Okay, I got it. So we're focused on both the teller and the recipient of the story and kind of that thing that happens in between the two. So one person is communicating something to another.
Exactly. And on that notion of making believe and belief and doubt figuring largely in the way I talk about stories, wonder and wondering, the way in which stories, in a sense, stimulate both.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you say right now we need the comfort with contradiction that storytelling offers. I was wondering if you could explain what you mean by comfort with contradiction.
Sure. Well, it's when I think of stories, I think of the earliest stories I heard. And the earliest stories I heard began with a phrase that my family would use and went like this, you know, once upon a time.
Yeah.
And I think about how when we were very young, when we're all very young, if we're lucky and get told stories, we quickly understand that once upon a time means right now. So we begin our storytelling experience embracing a contradiction, that things are both true and not true, that this once upon a time is happening right now. And it fits with two things. One is the way in which language works. I always turn to Marshall McLuhan, and Marshall McLuhan was one of my teachers at the University of Toronto way back when. And one of the phrases I remember is he talked about how out of meaningless signs and sounds, we give shape and meaning to the world. That sense of language, oral or written, as helping us make sense of the world, and stories are the instrument we use with language to pick up on that. And with that, there is that contradiction about words both are something and are not something. I tell a story at the beginning of the book about the word CAT. In grade one, the teacher put it, wrote it on the board and asked me what that was. And I said it was three letters, three CAT. She said, "That's the cat." I said, "That's not a cat. That's three letters and on the board." And as I say, that day didn't end well. But by the next day, I was quite comfortable with it. And I think it was partly because my father, that evening of that bad day, pointed to a picture of a horse that I had on the calendar on the wall. And he said, "Is that a horse?" And of course, I had to say yes. And then he sort of just gently said, "You know, that's, and CAT is a cat too, in the same sort of way." And I think that we learn that so early, we naturalize it. We think it comes naturally to associate a word with a thing that it refers to. And that too is part of storytelling. And many of the other thing is I mentioned Once Upon a Time is that it was the beginning of storytelling for many of us. In many cultures, and I do a lot of traveling to do with storytelling. Many cultures, the storytellers often begin a story with a phrase. In Mallorca, say "Aixuir in Eire," which means "it was and it was not." And the Khoi Khoi in Southern Africa, the Bushman people that I've worked with, they have a word, "Narube," which means "the happening that's not happening." And it's kind of the same as Once Upon a Time. It sort of signals that we're moving into a domain where things are, you know, even though they're not. And that kind of comfort with contradiction, it seems to me, we're more comfortable with contradiction than we realize. We live on a round earth, but we live as though it were a flat earth. We talk about the sunrise and sunset when we know the sun doesn't do any such thing. And so it's trying to remind a reader that we know more about this than we realize.
Yeah, I think I misinterpreted the phrase, because I was looking at comfort with contradiction as being sort of comfort plus contradiction, as if they were two different things. But what you're talking about is we need to be comfortable with the idea of contradiction. And we have that built in. We have that almost inherent to us because of the way that we've grown up with stories and the stories that are around us. We are able to take a communication or a tale that comes from somewhere and recognize that it can be true and not true simultaneously.
Yes, that's the kind of comfort with contradiction that I think about and talk about in the book. And I think it's very important, even as we retain our not just ability, but the necessity of saying that's not true about certain things and about certain stories.
Yeah.
We all know the importance of that these days.
Yeah.
Our response to stories has always, I think, been complex. And that complexity should be a comfort to us.
Yeah. Okay. So why in particular do we need this now? And maybe I should just jump to the question is what these stories do for us. What do they provide for us? Why is this so important for us to get this comfort with contradiction?
Well, my sense is we need it now for a variety of reasons. One is so that we can accommodate a particular range of stories that I have in mind, spiritual stories and scientific stories, and fit them in with our notion of stories that entertain us, you know, take us away from the world in a variety of ways, but in doing so, take us deeper into human experience. And I think we need it now because it's a time of, I won't say unparalleled, but unusual distress for many people. The uncertainties that we are living with, whether it's the climate, whether it's the ways in which we're governed or govern ourselves, all of those things are really troubling. Storytelling can help us deal with that troubling element, because if we think about it, we've been doing this within stories and storytelling all our lives. Stories will often take us place. I remember, and I'm sure many of us remember, a time when we went to sleep after hearing stories that were scary. Now, what was happening there? Well, one of them was we were developing a capacity to balance belief and doubt, believing and not believing, and fear and beauty. And I think we need to sort of realize how powerful this is in the way sad songs can make us happy and beautiful music can make us cry. We're accustomed to contradiction in ways that can help us now deal with some of the contradictions and some of the imbalances that we're surrounded by. In one area, I think it's really important on the climate. We could learn much from many indigenous storytelling traditions, because they often go back to times when the climates were changing. They go back thousands of years often, and they give all kinds of insight into how people's accommodated changes and adapted to changes. And in this case, it's a change that we are party to, as it were, because we're part of the cause of the climate change. But nonetheless, whatever causes it, it's very distressing for many, many people. And the uncertainty is unnerving for many of us. And I just think our capability, shaped by storytelling, can help us deal with those uncertainties and those contradictions.
Right. But sometimes stories have a reputation of oversimplifying or providing a kind of comfort that doesn't bear a connection with reality, a sort of, there will be a, you know, everyone will live happily ever after, or there might be a simple explanation, you know, for the storm is that the gods are angry and they're rolling bowling balls across the sky, or, you know, whatever the story is. So, but it sounds like what you're saying, though, is if we look for the right stories, we'll find something that will be more helpful and not just cause us all to live with a false sense of security.
Yes. I mean, I don't think, though, we need to go around just worrying about whether the story is right or not. I think storytelling itself is something that we've come to take naturally, as we've naturalized it. But I think we're in danger of forgetting, as I will say again, the contradictions and uncertainties that they present. I mean, one of the oldest storytelling forms, certainly in the narrative poetry that you mentioned in the opening, is the riddle. Mm. And the riddle is a deeply troubling form, because it says something that's, it's either the words of the world are right, and our understanding of one or the other, and we have to figure out which and how to deal with that. And that storytelling tradition has been with us for ages and still is. And a metaphor, saying something is something that's not, my love is a red rose, is again a storytelling form that we use all the time and have become quite comfortable with, and we forget how radical it is. And it's that return to understanding the radical nature of much storytelling that I think we need to recover in order to help us deal with many of the challenges that are around us. And you know, the thing, I mean, our challenges, of course, always feel desperate to us. But human beings have been dealing with challenges for as long as there have been human beings, but certainly for 100,000 years. And stories have helped. Mm. And if they've helped them, they can help us.
Right. Okay. So I think I get it. So it's almost like the examples I was giving of stories that might seem like they're oversimplifying or explaining something in a way that isn't quite true. In fact, even that action or even that, the assessing that can actually help us see that even those stories or even the use of a metaphor or something like that can actually help us understand just how complex our use of language is and our use of things like metaphor, that it's showing us that there are tools that can help us organize the world or better understand our position in it. And it's kind of the tools are as complicated as the universe itself, that they're full of paradoxes. They're full of all kinds of challenging and complicated features that if we take the time to sort of scrutinize them, we'll see that there's really rich material there that engages all of our intellectual faculties.
And that we're better at balancing. Yeah. Than we think we are, because so many of the storytelling traditions, and I think of the spiritual and the scientific, ask us to believe in two contradictory things, the Christ of faith and the Christ of history, for example. Or the scientist says things can be in two places at once. And even though we may not understand what quantum theory is all about, we take that seriously and we believe in our capacity to accommodate the contradictions. I'm sitting at a desk here, solid wood desk. One part of me knows that inside that desk, there are billions of very small particles going at the speed of light to and fro, and it's not nearly as solid as I think it is. And I find it quite easy to accommodate both beliefs. I believe in what the scientists, the particle physicists say to me, and I believe that it's a sound desk and I can keep my books on it and they won't fall through.
Let's take a quick break and come back with, I have kind of a turn that I think this is going to take that hopefully you can help us unpack. Okay, we're back. So, Ted, now I'm very interested in what you mean by the ethics of storytelling. And everything we've talked about, I don't know exactly I don't have the key to unlock what makes a story or the act of storytelling ethical.
Because of the power of stories, and as you can tell, I believe that stories are a very powerful part of our mental and physical lives. We live within and by stories. I think because stories affect both individuals and shape societies, we need to be careful about being reckless with them. There are reckless words that we all are aware of. They may be racist or sexist. They may be words that diminish people who aren't exactly like us. And we need to be very careful about phrases. And one of the ones that is deadly as any is that Columbus discovered America. Because Columbus discovered America puts in play a whole series of, I'll call them understandings, but they're misunderstandings about who we are and where we belong. I mean, and one of the things that we forget about, but I think are beginning to remember, is that Columbus arrived at America, and there was an encounter between two great civilizations, European and indigenous American. That was 1492. In 1493, the Pope in Rome issued what was called the Doctrine of Discovery, which not just approved of, but instructed European nations to go and in the countries they, quote, discovered, to take over the land because there was nobody there. And the nobody there is quite quickly became a legal doctrine, terra nullius it was called, which said, go ahead, take over that land, and if you find people there, they're nobodies. And for 500 years, indigenous peoples in the Americas and in Australia and in Southern Africa have been shadowed by that notion of being nobodies, living in the shadow, as it were, for 500 years. And that story feeds into our notions of the primitive and the developed countries and underdeveloped people. It plays into our naming of places, the ways in which we put names on them, take names away from them, and destroy important storylines that indigenous peoples have had for thousands of years. I think one of the ethics of that I'm talking about is how careful we need to be, not so cautious we worry about doing anything, but respectful of and open to the notion that the stories we're living with aren't necessarily true in the way we take them to be true, and our belief in them does damage to other peoples. And I'm thinking here particularly of indigenous peoples, as we call native peoples mostly in Canada. As far as the ethics of storytelling go, the trouble is policing storytelling is like herding cats. It ends easy. Or it ends up what the police sometimes call kettling them, putting them all in, you know, down a dead-end street, according to the current categories of what we think are proper stories. And that leads to what we're seeing, sadly, far too often, banning books and things. I think we need to trust our own instincts more than we sometimes do, but we need to make sure that we don't reinforce, but use stories to explain and illustrate divisions, hierarchies, antagonisms, ignorance, and so forth, and heal ourselves with some of our storytelling.
But it is a difficult question. I was thinking of this example. I might say, as part of the story that I'm telling myself, you know, I am an American. We're the nation that got rid of a king. That's why I value free and fair elections and a classless society. And my neighbor might say, well, I'm an American. We're the nation that got rid of a king. And that's why I own 10 guns and hate the government. We're both kind of starting from the same premise and telling ourselves a story that is rooted in some kind of truth and some kind of factual experience. But how do we decide which of us is right and you know, who gets to make that decision?
Well, I think at the end of the day, we do. We need to trust our instincts on this. Mm-hmm. I think we sometimes forget that we're pretty good at sussing out the stories that we think are doing us wrong or doing our communities wrong. And community is so important in all storytelling. I mean, in a sense, storytelling begins with, and probably tens of thousands of years ago, began with someone telling a story to someone else, whether it was in a cave, and the story could be a drawing on the wall, a painting on the wall or whatever. But all of a sudden, there was that connection between people that stories nourished and have since continued to satisfy in all sorts of ways. We need to sort of bring our own instincts to bear on this. One of the hazards is we can tend to depend on what we see as I've talked about policing stories, the folks who are in my trade, sort of literary scholarship, the critics, the interpreters, to do that. We take it seriously, and I often am asked, what do you do at university? Well, my answer has always been the same. We tell stories, and we try to instill belief in the truth of those stories in our students. If we're successful, they've taken on the truth of them, we give them a credit for the course. And credit means simply he or she believes. Mm. We're in the belief business in education, and we need to be very careful about how we play that out And we need to, I often say, I think stories and an understanding that what we know of the world, we know through stories. And recognizing that changing a story may make all the difference in the world, just as changing the story about Columbus discovering America would make all the difference if we were to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. And we all have that power to do it because we're so familiar with stories.
We all have the power to do it. Yeah, we never want to underestimate our own capacity. We can turn to critics, we can turn to interpreters, but the kind of test case is in our, you know, our heart and soul, our mind. And you know, I often think of sort of ways in which we, more than we realize, we do this, I won't say naturally, but we've naturalized our ability to do this. And one thing that is fascinating to me, because I taught poetry a lot, we don't pay as much attention as we might to song. Mm. Now, song is often centrally storytelling, and it has capacity to bring together contradictions in ways that we're not conscious of. I'm thinking of an old, I often tell this story, an old cowboy song that I learned growing up out here in the West, Home on the Range. And Home on the Range was immensely popular. It was, came into being. It was written by what they call a saddleback doctor who traveled by horse from place to place out of Kansas out to the West in the 1870s. And it's been immensely popular, certainly for 150 years. And it begins, "Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam." And home and roam, they're bound together by sound, and they're absolutely opposite in sense, and represent a fundamental human contradiction about, you know, staying in one place or moving around. And our imagination takes this in every time we sing it or hear it, and we celebrate our fondness for it. And that fondness helps heal us from the antagonism of thinking that one is the right way and one's not the right way of living.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think we need to, if we can pay more attention to how stories work and work on us in good ways, we'll be able to sort out the ones we want to hold on to and the ones we want to get rid of.
Right.
The Jamaicans, my wife is Jamaican, and they have a lovely phrase for a song or a story that should be taken out of its misery. They say, "It need fi dead." And I think there are some storylines and things that need fi dead. We need to get rid of them.
Yeah.
And need to even have the courage and the determination to take them out of the action.
And sometimes those might be the stories that feel good, that feel the best to us. For example, it seems very powerful when a story is saying, "Well, you're a victim," or "You're right to be afraid," or there's a good reason for you to be angry, or stories like that. And they can be used by propagandists and the powerful to mobilize people and to try to sway people to their side. But it's those stories, maybe in particular, we need to be careful about, well, is what I'm hearing true? Is what I'm hearing driving me to a place that's not consistent with my values, or is it dangerous for me to fall into this trap of buying into the story that is ultimately going to cause harm to others?
No, we do indeed. That's quite true, and we need to be ready to sort of take on the hazards of those stories and to think about stories that will nourish us rather than undermine our sense of agency. What I'm trying to do in the book is to help us do that, to decide what stories are good for us and why they are or why they're not. One of the interesting things about stories is how we believe them most fiercely in company of others. I mean, I think of religious creeds. and the way in which we may recite them if we belong to an institutional religion, that we recite things and say, I believe in, et cetera, et cetera. And what we're believing in is radically contradictory often to our experience of the world. The same thing happens with national anthems. We sing them together. We sing them heartily. We sing them sort of, you know, with whole hearts, as it were. And they often aren't true in a variety of ways. And I think of the Canadian national anthem. Begins, O Canada, our home and native land. Well, it should be our home on native land, because the land isn't native to many of us. Bless the many of us who have come as settlers, which is the majority of the population now. But we sing that, and we, for a moment or two, we believe it, and it's wrong, and it really diminishes the heritage of indigenous people who've been here for thousands of years, and we've been here for maybe, if we're you know, old-time settlers, a few hundred. But nonetheless, we need to recognize both the wonders of telling stories in a community and the hazards. We need to get back to that trust in our own instinct in our own storytelling and to sort of go with that. And it can be really, really important. One of the very formidable hospitals in Canada, in Toronto, called the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, started a program to try to deal with what is sadly too often around the world an epidemic of suicide. And they came up with a phrase, not suicide, not today. And that not today was the most wonderful thing, because it didn't say, you know, suicide is a bad thing, don't do it. They said, just wait a day and tell a story. Tell your story. Find someone to tell it to. There will be someone. If necessary, phone this number, but tell your story. And that may help you move to tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of instinct to use stories, your stories, as well as other people's stories, and recognize the agency you have in the stories that are yours, and use it to save your life. But not because it's a good thing to save your life, but just because it will save your life. The evidence has certainly been clear in the last 2 years that campaign has been underway. The numbers have dropped significantly. And it's because people tell their stories and then start listening to stories and then start finding ways of sharing their stories. And one of the things that is wonderful about stories is how they bring us into the company of others within the story. Oscar Wilde used to say that the people he knew best were the people he met in stories. He also said that they were often the people he liked most.
Yeah. But,
I mean, we get to know people in stories very well, and that knowledge of each other, as it were, can help us.
Mm.
Can I just take a moment here?
Sure.
There's one question on people's minds about technology and what hazards it presents. I think as we move to the virtual, being there and not there, happening that's not happening, I think we may find new possibilities, just as we did with the technologies of photography and telephone and radio and film and so forth. So I'm very optimistic about what the new technology, it'll have its hazards. I think that the storytelling in a variety of technologies can save us, you know, can help us. It's clearly done this before, it'll do it again.
Okay. Well, that's an optimistic note to end on. Professor Chamberlain, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
No, it was a great pleasure.
And guess what, people? I made a mistake earlier on in the episode. I said we would hear from Iceland Green, but she didn't deliver on my last book. She gave us some choices for her books to take on the road, which we've already passed along. You can hear those in our interview with Iceland in the archives. Instead, we will present the selection of poet Xinyi Pai, who, like Iceland, lives in Seattle. After we discussed Xinyi's work as a poet and podcaster, I asked her this special question. Okay, we're here with Xinyi Pai, civic poet of Seattle and host of the podcast 10,000 Things. Xinyi, this question comes from a listener who asks, what do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written.
So I had so many thoughts when you shared this question.
Yeah, 10,000 books.
Well, my first thought would actually be that I wouldn't want to read a book, like, on my deathbed. Mm-hmm. I'd want to be listening to music because sound is the last sense that leaves our consciousness as we are in that process of dying. It's why, like, monks chant to us or we recite the sutras. It's the thing that hangs on and is the last to go. So I think the medium of listening is really powerful, whereas the experience of reading is a very different one that involves, you know, the mind as much as the senses. But in the interest of trying to answer your listener's question in some kind of way, I think I would refer back to some of the books that were really important to me when I started reading about and thinking about the convergences of the sacred and the spiritual. So that might, to be completely honest, it might be Sogyal Rinpoche's The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, because that would be a text for preparing for death. But if we were to go more literary, it might be something like Zen Master Dogen's treatise, Moon in a Dewdrop, which is about, like, the experience of nothingness. And I also think about Ruth Ozeki's book, For the Time Being, which is also, it's a work of fiction, it's a novel, but it is deeply about the sensibility of the ineffable and what changes, what can't be held onto and has very kind of Zen Buddhistic tendencies as well. But my true answer is really that I would listen to music, actually. Yeah.
What kind of music would you want to be listening to?
Oh, you know, I'd want to listen to something that was like instrumental. Maybe there would be voices, but it wouldn't necessarily be like lyrical kind of music. Mm-hmm. I listen a lot to music by a Seattle composer named Steve Peters, and I find his music really comforting during psychedelic journeys, and could imagine something like that, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people, they want to return to their childhood, or they want to find humor, they want to feel comforted, but a lot of people view it as, well, I want to get ready for the next phase. In your choice of books and your choice of music and the choice to have it be music, are you thinking of this as you kind of should get yourself ready, that you should be in the right frame of mind and you should kind of have a sort of contemplative state or a meditative state that would help you in preparing for what comes next?
Well, I think that for any writer, there are certain stories that need to be told. Like, there's a personal essay collection that I'm working on that I will probably be working on for another 10 years. I've already worked on for 10 years. And I feel like, to a degree, these stories from my community, they're stories that I want people to know and to circulate. But I think related to that, like, these stories, like, why I tell them, they are stories that help me to heal and to tell my own stories about identity and loss and diaspora. In conversations that I've had with a really close artistic friend and somebody who's become a co-author of different projects, had some conversations with her about trauma. And she has described something to me that, like, there is this fourth phase of trauma, which is actually being able to place the trauma or to let it go into the public. And with that, there's the kind of releasing of that trauma. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the stories that I tell are about trauma. I am completely opposed to trauma porn in the kind of stories that I tell. But I think that there is a kind of transformation of that trauma, hopefully for the storyteller, but definitely within myself. And so this is something that I haven't quite found a way to articulate well. yet, but I think that it is part of that sensibility of the bittersweet. And if we are talking about preparing for what needs to be let go or evolving into a whole different kind of artist, which I'm sure there will be other artistic identities for myself in the future, I think that part of the work that I am doing now is around that transformation of trauma that hasn't been spoken for me, in me, in so long, and that I'm ready to put those stories down and not carry them anymore.
Shin Yi Pai, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go. My thanks to Shin Yi Pai, Mike Palindrome, and Professor Ted Chamberlain for joining me today. And I guess Emily Dickinson and Taylor Swift. I can thank them as well. Two great women of their respective eras. One of them known by just about everyone in her lifetime. One of them hardly known by anyone outside of her family. But Dickinson has done well for herself over the past century and a half or so. One wonders if the same will be true for Ms. Swift. We will see. Maybe she'll pass Jonathan on the most famous Swifts in literature list, if she hasn't already. Maybe that depends on how you view lyrics, whether they are literature or not. We know from the Dylan Nobel Prize kerfluffle that opinions on that question are sharply divided. Speaking of sharply divided, I hope you and I are not sharply divided. I hope we're on the same page and that you'd like to join me for upcoming shows on Scottish thriller writer John Buchan, author of The 39 Steps. We'll talk to one of his, descendants, who's written a biography of him. And we'll take a look at Jack London's very literary and nearly forgotten wife. Hopefully we can change that. And Tove Jansson, the creator of the Moomin Trolls. We'll talk to her biographer as well, and some Ralph Waldo Emerson to keep things elevated, and some Margaret Fuller to elevate even higher than that. Super elevated. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.